Could you please introduce yourselves and who you are to each other? And maybe, Claudine, we can start with you.
Hi, I'm Claudine de Villiers. I'm married to Adrian for 17 years. We've been married for 18 years in October, but we know each other for over 20 years, maybe.
Yeah, about
24 years, yeah.
And Adrian, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Adrian. I'm a trading manager at a fresh produce facility. I'm going to be 50 one of these days. Yeah, so that is me in a nutshell.
What did you guys bond over in the beginning?
Humor, to be honest with you. She's got a mad sense of humor, and I've got a dry sense of humor. And we play off each other's humorous moments and anecdotes and, you know, certain... taking the mickey out of each other people, just general humor, and I found that attractive, besides self-attractive.
That is a sweet thing to say, thank you.
Could you please share who of you have been diagnosed with a disorder and what is it? If there are multiple, please clarify if you're comfortable to do that.
In July, August of 2021, I was diagnosed with bipolar. But it was a dual diagnosis. I had suffered addiction and was addicted to certain substances, which was alcohol and marijuana. That was my drugs of choice, yeah.
And had you been dealing with addiction prior to your bipolar or...?
Yeah, no, I was trying to deal with my addiction, but I relapsed, yeah, just before I was diagnosed with bipolar.
At what point in your relationship with Claudine did this diagnosis, this dual diagnosis, manifest itself?
I think it's been manifesting for a while in our relationship. And I think the dual diagnosis bipolar was only, like I said, only acknowledged in 2021. But during the relationship, I would say my addiction was probably from a young age already. I just thought of it as part of the culture, part of being a man, having a party, enjoying myself. So I didn't see myself as addicted to these substances. I just thought I could stay away from it for a few months. But I could never be... I always looked for escape, and I found it in drugs, basically. That's what I did. So from my side, I was in the relationship with Claudine, but having these demons of drugs piggybacking on me for this long time. I tried to get clean a few months, maybe even a year, but not working a program, not having a sponsor, not having any of those type of support systems only led me to be short-lived sobriety, yeah. I just had short-lived sobriety, yeah.
And was this, you speak about your addiction kind of, you use the words kind of piggybacking on you into the relationship and through it for what was ultimately 15 years before then the bipolar diagnosis came as well. Was this abuse of marijuana and alcohol something that you had concealed from Claudine at all?
No, she met me consuming these drugs and stuff like that. And it was probably, we were both, she was younger than me, like she's mentioned. And it was not a, what's the word I'm looking for, a taboo. It wasn't taboo, it was accepted because you were in a group of friends. Everybody's, you know, basically doing it. You know, our young life, student life, and those things happen. So I just didn't grow up from there. That's my problem. I'm still, was still stuck in the party life or the I need to get smashed, yeah, lifestyle, yeah. And I never progressed from there. And it started when I was young, obviously. I needed to get high. I needed to get drunk. I needed to party when you do alcohol and a bit of marijuana, you don't think you're so bad as the druggies and stuff like that. But in the meantime, it's probably worse drug because it's socially more acceptable, the alcohol. So you don't get banished to the corners.
Hmm. Claudine, I'd like to move this over to you for a second. At what point did you confront this challenge in your relationship?
For me, it's been a long time coming, but it really hit home when we went into hard lockdown. So because he's in fresh produce, he's essential services, because obviously people need to eat. So he never had those. So we had 27 days, or whatever it was, level 5. So we had to be indoors. We couldn't really go out. He never had that. So at the start of lockdown, he came home with a bag of weed, which he started using daily because we couldn't go anywhere. And we'd always have alcohol in the house, you know, for if people come visit. And that started to be consumed because we had nothing to do, really. We were indoors. Everybody was doing it. So I would say for me, the worst time when it really became very bad for me was from March 2020. That was kind of a turning point for me. And I got a call. Oh, you don't mind me sharing this?
You can share anything.
And so he was at work, and then he called me to say he has to work late. So I thought, okay, cool, that's fine. I'll just, because I'm home, it's fine. And I got a call from one of his colleagues to say that he's passed out on the floor because he was drinking so much. So the fact that he could call me and just lie to me that easily, it got to me. And it kind of escalated from there. And he almost justified his actions by, but I'm working hard. What am I supposed to do? We can't go out. We must be at home. And I would find him like in the lane, 10 o'clock in the morning, smoking a joint. And then he would get upset with me because why am I going on about him smoking one joint? But it's like 10 o'clock in the morning. And it just escalated like that. And the breaking point for me was in 2021. We stopped taking his meds and he started smoking like all the time. And I had to actually book him into a clinic because I didn't know what to do with him. So at that point, he wasn't diagnosed with bipolar. He just had depression. And that was, so he was booked in 2018 for depression. But Dr. Feast always said she felt like there was something missing with the diagnosis. And in July 2021... I didn't know what to do with him. He stopped taking his meds, he started smoking, he just started drinking, and he just became erratic. So I was forced to book him into the clinic where Dorothy is, because she is his therapist. Okay. I was like, well. And then that was a very difficult time.
Okay.
I'm giving you a totally watered-down version of this whole events. We got very sick in 2020 with the first wave of COVID. Both of us were in ICU. I was on a ventilator at death's door. AD was also very sick. My dad also went on a ventilator and we lost him.
I'm so sorry.
So what was also happening was that because we were all forced to stay indoors and he was going to work, he had it in his mind and still has it in his mind that he made me sick and made my father sick. So he killed my father, basically. And it just spiraled from there for him. He wasn't dealing with it well. But I lost the father as well. And I had to keep my shit together, you know what I mean? I couldn't. I never had the luxury of doing what he did. And I'm still suffering from long COVID. So I have limited lung capacity. I have, from the ventilator, I have my left vocal cord is paralyzed. That's why I sound like this. So there were times when, like, I couldn't breathe. I was feeling sick and we would go somewhere. So he would insist we go somewhere where he knows he can smoke, or that person smokes, or they have weed, or they'll be drinking. And then even if they're always feeling like that, sick, tired, I would still have to drive home.
How did you feel in those moments?
Like, I can't actually put it in words, but like nothing, worthless. Like, I just couldn't understand how somebody can just not care about me at all in that way. You know, we had a different situation because we were both in hospital together at our, like, close to death. And we recovered in the same way. So, in a way, that was good, because I know some people have issues now with people having long COVID. The spouses don't believe that they're sick. But, I mean, both of us know what we went through. So there was never that. But I just felt the lack of love and support.
When you're carrying that with you, that feeling of neglect, and then you mentioned the I had to keep my shit together. You then kept your shit together as well when you then booked AD in, which must have been quite difficult as well.
We are very private people in that I'm very close to my parents and I have one sister. And we share everything, right? So if I tried to hide everything from everybody, but I couldn't. I really couldn't. I could feel my health was deteriorating. I just looked at myself in the mirror and thought, you look like you're going to die. You actually just look so sick. In a word, I was just defeated.
Did you know that by that point you didn't know that about the bipolar diagnosis?
No, but at that point, I kind of had a clear. I was like, I mean, what next?
I don't want to get into kind of the details of, you know, the step-by-step of what that day looked like. But afterwards, when you've been seen to and you then are kind of, you know, either sitting together in therapy or sitting across from each other, and you then have that conversation of, I am an addict and I have been diagnosed with bipolar. What did that conversation look like? Or what was that experience like for you with Claudine?
There's a bit of a prequel to this. So that I can keep the timeline straight. Before I actually went off my meds, I stopped using. I was convinced I can DIY NA, Narcotics Anonymous. I've done it before. I stopped using. And then I thought to myself, I don't need my meds. The meds that I stopped using without Dr. Fee's involvement made me manic, made me delusional. I thought I was talking to God. I was speaking to my father, to her father, on the photos on the wall. She booked me the Sunday in. I was convinced the nurses were... had to get me. I was then taken to a government institution, hospital for observation for 3 days. And I guess, and it was during COVID as well. And I guess if I didn't act right, I would have been taken to the state facility for an indefinite period. I actually decided to pray to my power. And he brought me through to where Claudine and her sister came to fetch me without clothes, basically, from the state institution or hospital, government hospital. I then went for 21 days into treatment. And I didn't see Claudine for that all of the 21 days. I tried to contact her. But she wasn't quite interested at that stage. So I decided to take everything serious. And I can safely say I haven't used till that since that time. And that's when Dr. Fees diagnosed me with bipolar disorder as well.
What was the first conversation like when you did reconnect?
So Dorothy called me and said, can we have a session with you both, because he's going to be discharged tomorrow. Would I be willing to come? And then I went and we sat across from each other and he just assumed he's coming home. And she asked me, are you ready for him to come home? And I said, no, I don't know. And I could see in that moment his face fell, because we reached a different part in our relationship. I've never said that ever. And then I asked him, does he have somewhere to go? And you said, actually, no, but you can make a plan. And then I came home and I thought about everything. My mother and my sister were livid, because other things happened in between. So they just said, whatever I want to do. My mom said, if I want to come home, I can come home. But then I thought, why am I moving? You know what I mean? Why must I move? I did nothing. If we can't work this out and we go our separate ways, then he has to go. I can't tell you exactly when the moment was that I felt we're doing this. I don't think there was a moment, because I lost a lot of trust in the fact that it was just so easy for him to lie to me, like to my face. It was just easy, and I couldn't get past that. It took me a long time to get past that. I still feel a bit sometimes, you know, but what I must say is, when he does tell me he hasn't used, or he's honest about, if we go somewhere and he says, oh, he sees a beer and he really feels like having a beer, I appreciate that honesty, instead of him keeping it in his back of his mind and then it bubbling there and then him using. So I don't have an exact point where I said, let's do this. It was more of a navigation between the two of us and kind of trying to build back that trust for me. So there wasn't that one light bulb moment where I said, today's the day. No, it really took a long time. For me.
Adrian, for you, was there anything that came from your side in terms of, forgive me, I don't know the process of rehabilitation, so I'm not exactly sure of the steps that you took, but from what I'm understanding, you of course wanted to come back home, come back to your family. What were you saying from your side, when I'm sure you can understand the broken trust, you can understand the hurt?
I think the honesty, like she says, and I tell her, wow, I want that beer, doesn't look too bad. Maybe not on a day like this, hot day in Cape Town. Yeah, honesty. But more than honesty, it was a sense of, you have to choose. Choose your drugs or choose the relationship. And I've obviously made the best choice I could make. But the process was obviously the support I got within the clinic, but the realization that the best thing in my life was Claudine, and I was going to lose it to such arbitrary thing as weed and alcohol. I thought, no man, she deserves better. And I did tell her, if we end it, it's all on me. I couldn't make any more promises, because I broke promises, I lied to her, I was doing things behind her back. I think I did also not have a light bulb moment. It was understanding that it is a disease and treating it as a disease. And once I started recognizing that I've got this problem, the only way to deal with this is being totally honest about what I need. And what I needed was help from Claudine, because I don't think she accepted me. That would be my real rock bottom if she had to say, enough is enough. So that boundary she put in place by saying, okay, you can come back, but on condition, no loving, no touching, no everything, you must do your things on your own. That was the tough love that I needed.
How do you lean on Claudine, and how do you feel about having to lean on her?
For the diagnosis, I feel that I go from one extreme where I'm totally invincible and confident to where I am in my shell, and I don't get out of bed. Claudine is my safety net. I think it makes me feel sad, because I know what I'm doing is wrong. I know what I'm doing to her is kind of cowardly. Yes, cowardly. Letting her take up all the responsibility for what I'm going through. and she's my therapist, my caregiver. She's all of those things wrapped into one. I just have trust issues, and she's the only person I can trust here. And going through this life, I've always put people on their pedestals, and she's the only one that actually lived up. You know, never meet your heroes. I married my hero. You know what I mean? Yeah.
It's a bit extreme.
No, that's true. But that is true. But no, that is true. No, what I mean is that she's really, she says I'm not enough for you, but that's because I'm an addict. I have substance abuse issues. But besides that, she knows the percentage of me, not the good percentage of me, rates her as one of the best people out there. And I value her opinion, and anything I do, I'll go through her first.
Claudine, I just wanted to come to you there. I know it's technically, in the grand scheme of things, maybe early days, but you did stay and you have played this role. Can you walk me through that?
I don't think it's like I'm staying because I'm comfortable. I don't think it's that. I've thought about this before. What I can tell you is that something is different this time around. Like, he's really trying, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Where before, I felt like I was just nagging, and I felt like he was kind of doing it for me. But I don't feel like that. I actually feel like he's doing it for himself. Like, I must say that I do get very angry because he does put a lot on me, and he expects a lot from me.
Mm.
So you say it's not an even playing field. It's not. Because I do feel like I give a lot of myself, more than he gives. But the thing is, maybe that's all he has to give for now. And I kind of have to accept that. But I also have this conflict inside, like, am I not worth more? Am I doing the right thing? Do I regret it? Not really. Because, you know, I've always said this. If you both grow together and you both work together, marriage is like the best because we don't have kids. So we can do whatever the hell we want. But if we continue to struggle, it's not going to be great for either of us. If we're not both giving as we should, for a long time I felt like I was giving like 99% and he's giving 1%. I guess that is life. You have all these challenges, and but sometimes the challenges just get a bit too much. But yeah, I think for me, the only way that I can go forward is if I continuously see the effort that he puts in. I can't answer you if you're going to ask me, what would you do if you used again? I can't answer that question. I don't know. I don't know what I would do, but it would kill me, I think. And I think that would be it for me.
I think that's really beautiful how you put it. As hard as it must be to accept that somebody's 100% only reflects as like 20% to you, realizing that they're giving as much as they can give in the moment is really big. Yeah, I think that. Thank you for sharing all of that. What pillars of communication do you have in place to navigate this stage that you're at? And, you know, you've mentioned now, you know, you can't even think about what might happen if there is, you know, another crisis or if there is a relapse. That, of course, I understand. But, you know, right now, do you have daily check-ins, or what is your communication looking like between the two of you right now? Maybe, Adrian, you can start.
I think what the daily communication is, I don't think we don't have a schedule of today. We're going to do this. We're going to ask you either this. Claudine has a good way of getting things out of me now. And I've also learned now to tell her exactly what's going on in my head and how I feel. And I think that's been good, but it also drains her. I'm trying, but it's definitely, she is more gentle with me. And I think the lines of communication is that I don't have to be afraid to tell her anything. But the best line of communication is the love we have with each other, I'd say.
So what we always do is we would lay in bed at night and just talk about your day and laugh and that before you sleep. And that has helped. We do it a lot. We do it so much. So kind of getting back into the little things, because that's a big thing for me. So that was a thing that we used to do a lot of. And we kind of started getting back into good patterns, I would say.
For other people going through a similar experience, how important is it to have your individual communities to support each other?
I must say that a therapist for the trauma and everything that we went through, so I never saw a therapist before. So Adi has always just seen Dorothy. And then when he was diagnosed with bipolar, and he started seeing a therapist. So he's seen two people. But I started seeing one because basically my doctor forced me after I came out of hospital for PTSD and all of that. And that wasn't like that essential to me, but it actually is good to check in every month. My family is very important to me. So in terms of that, the broader community, maybe your family not so much, but my mom and my sister definitely for me. My therapist, luckily I have doctors and physiotherapists and that are, I've got an occupational therapist as well, that is helping me through certain things that maybe I don't feel comfortable telling him, like everything, because he is a worrier. And when he worries differently to me. He will like have sleepless nights, and I don't worry like that. He needs more than what I have, I would say.
Yeah, I can say from my side, I'm fortunate, besides the professional help, obviously Narcotic Anonymous and the fellowship within it, some open groups as well. I'm also fortunate to have a colleague at work, and I'm quite open with him chatting at work. So I've got a little community at work as well. So I'm fortunate to have, when I leave to go to work, I can have people I can lean on. When I come back home, I can lean on Claudine. When I go to an NA, I'm actually quite fortunate. And it's imperative that as an addict, you have these communities and connections. Because if you don't have these connections, I can tell you, you're going to start falling apart, and then you're going to go back to that rabbit hole of drug abuse. But I'd say if it wasn't for these communities that I'm in, I would have faltered.
What have you learnt from each other through this experience? How have you grown as people through this?
You know, I'm still, honestly, I'm still asking myself, what is my purpose? Why am I alive? Why was I spared or whatever it is? But maybe it was to help him even. My mother, my sister, whatever it is. What I learned about him is I'm very resilient, 100%.
The one thing I've learned from Claudine, and I think she will realize, is that you can do anything you can set your mind to. If you just take it step by step, go through the motions and realize that people are human as well. So, you know, they also have, they bleed and go to the loo as you do. So the one thing she's good at is humanizing everybody. They are not God, they're only people. And that's something that I struggle with. I've always, like I said, so the one thing I learned from her is, you know what, try not take things too personal, but try to be more resilient, and this is what she is. So that's what I've learned from her. I'm growing a pair, and I think I'm turning the corner when it comes to that. It's taken me a while, but she's taught me resilience here. And that's what COVID has taught us, was to be resilient, yeah.
Yes, I couldn't do it without him. Like, when I was sick, I actually wrote him a letter, but it pissed me off. I wrote him a letter for our anniversary last year, but it just pissed me off, and then I just didn't give it to him. I typed it, and then I showed it to him 2 weeks ago, I think. And he was shocked. He said he didn't know that somebody thought or felt about him like that, or that somebody had so much nice things to say about him. But I never thanked him really for everything he did for me. I mean, I could do nothing for myself, not even shower. I was like an invalid, and he still does. You can still see at night when I'm struggling, to breathe, he will get my palms, get my nebula. It's just that little things that also has to bring me back down to ground. Like, I can't also live without him.
And if I can just say the last thing, God, the higher power, has also brought us closer. We're not maybe religious, but we're very spiritual in that regard. And I don't know anybody's take on, you know, if there is a higher power in their minds. But that, for me, going on my knees every day, I must say, I have to include that. Going on my knees every day, every morning, every night, thanking the Almighty for putting me in the position where I could have been dead, divorced, disowned, whatever it was, laying in the gutter, doesn't matter. I think through the higher power, through my God, through our God, he's brought me through this as well. And if I don't mention that, I'll be lying to you, because that is one big lean. That was one of my big leans. I'll be doing injustice to say it's just Claudine and myself. We both had time for reflection and time for prayer, and that has helped me. I can tell you that.
Thank you for sharing. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you. I hope we dwell you got some.